Hi there, just a quick word before we get into this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast. And it is a very, very different kind of episode to the usual, as you're about to find out, to be honest with you. I am not sure how I feel about it. I'm probably a little too close to it to have a sense of what you're going to think. But somebody decided somewhere that they would like to interview me for the podcast, and that was, of course, Carl Dieter, who you're about to find out. So I guess I'm just going to have to let you listen and see for yourself. Hopefully you trust that at this stage, we always like to put on a good show here on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Before we get into that, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Deluxe Bathrooms, and I thank them for getting involved. They're the reason that we get to show up here every week and give you a good laugh or something new to think about, or at least attempt to think about, or a little bit of escape to wind down from a tough week. You can check them out in Dundalk Retail Park and Eastgate Retail Park, Little Island, Cork, or of course online at deluxebathrooms.ie. Now, on with probably my most unusual podcast ever, but listen, I'll leave it up to yourself. On with the pod. Hello, everybody. Welcome. And today is a bit of an unusual one because my guest in studio is Carl Dieter. And you would remember Carl because he's been on my podcast a number of times in a number of different capacities. He's a brilliant commentator on American affairs. He's a brilliant commentator on finance, on housing, tech. He has his own tech company. He sold it there recently. And that's why he was on my podcast, because he sold it for a large amount of money. And we were celebrating his success about that. But then at the end of the last interview, before we turned off the mics, Carl said, "Do you know what? I'd like to interview you sometime." And we said, okay. And Patrick, more to the point, our producer, said, okay, that sounds like a great idea. And so here we are. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you.
I have no idea what's going on. There's been no preparation done. I really hope this is interesting. If it's not interesting, Patrick, I'm speaking directly into your ear now as the producer. We don't have to put it out. Patrick, don't put it out if it's not interesting enough. It won't be an offence to me and Carl, although he gives a shit about Carl because it's our podcast and not Carl's. We're giving Carl a chance to interview me. I don't know why Carl finds it that I would be interesting enough to interview. But listen, I'm going to take off my jacket now and I'm just going to hand it over to Carl Dieter. I have no idea what's going on. Over to you, Carl.
Woohoo. All right. All right. Well, look, you all know Mario Rosenstock. You listen to his show. You go to his live events. Maybe you were there when he packed the Three Arena several nights this year. You've laughed at a million funny skits that he's done. Maybe you saw him when he was an actor on Glen Row. You know, when it comes to music, he had a top 50 chart hit in the UK, a Christmas number one in Ireland. He's been on stage. He's had long-running shows on TV, on radio. He's a podcaster. Stacks of awards for his work. He's a good tennis player, dad of two children. He's blessed with a damn near endless talent and a work ethic. But do you know him? And that's really what I wanted to get to, is who is this guy? You know, the actual person outside these achievements. And today I hope to help you get to know him a bit better. And I'm giving this episode the preliminary name of The Unmasking of Mario. And that's my first question, actually. That we all wear a lot of masks, Mario. So I just want to start and say, if you were asked, like, who are you? What are your core beliefs?
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So I'm 55 years of age. I'm kind of Irish, born in London, but my dad was half German. My grandfather was German. He was a German soldier in the Wehrmacht. He was just an officer, a kind of a doctor and stuff. And they came to Ireland, and that's where the family started. I was brought up on a farm in Waterford, came to Dublin later, went to boarding school in Cork, and from an early age wanted to be an actor and wanted to perform. I'm not quite sure why I want to perform. I've always dug into that. As I've grown older, wondered why did I want to perform and all that? Why did I want to wear masks and hide behind things? But apart from what I do, I suppose it's hard to know who you are. I would like to think that as I've grown through my life, I have put a premium on independence. I feel very strongly a need for independence, to be independent, to be my own person, to be self-sufficient, to row my own boat, to be, to that extent then, to be a little different, to not always go with the flow, maybe to go against the tide. I remember thinking to myself, I'd never seen Riverdance. Everybody else is going, you got to see Riverdance. I'd never seen Riverdance. I never bought Aircom shares. If we're all going to this in the Croke Park, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to go. I recoil against that. So I have a strong streak of independence. I like to think that I have a strong sense of social justice, that I believe that the people who are weak should be
brought up in society, that the people who are have been let down should be encouraged. And I hate bullying. I think one of my pet hates is bullying. I cannot stand seeing people bullied, and I don't want to be a bully myself, and I hate people who bully. Beyond that, I think I would probably regard myself as loyal, possibly over loyal. In other words, I overvalue the word loyalty, because people let you down all the time, and they don't necessarily leave you down in a bad way. But when they do, sometimes I go, I was loyal to you. Why aren't you loyal to me? But actually, life isn't as simple as that. So I have an oversimplified view of loyalty. I'm a bit of a romantic. I can be sentimental. I think that would be the German in me. There's a strong sense of kitsch and sentimentality and nostalgia in German society. And I think that little bit of DNA makes me slightly sentimental. And I'm curious. I love people. I love watching people. I could easily sit in a cafe in Rome or Italy or anywhere and just observe people all day and giggle and wonder who that person is, what their relationship was with the person beside them. I've often sat on buses and trains, looked at people's heads, talking to each other and wonder what's their relationship, who's the power in that relationship, where's the, what's going on? And I go into my own little dream world. I love dreaming. You dream less when you get older. You become more practical and pragmatic. But I do love dreaming. Daydreaming is really important. I like daydreaming. I like looking out the window and not thinking anything, but that's when all the best thoughts happen. I suppose I could go on for hours, but I'll leave you with that for the moment.
You spoke to us about your kind of heritage. Well, let's keep with the idea of you know, Mario growing up. So tell me about being a child. What was your family set up? What was it like growing up?
I've actually talked about this a little bit, and I suppose it's a colourful subject. I had a very disassociative, disorganized, rickety upbringing. My mother was very young when she had me, about 22. My dad was only about 26. But they were not really probably meant to be together. So they fought a lot and they argued a lot. And
you have siblings?
Yeah, one brother, Rene. He's one year younger than me. And they fought a lot and they split up a lot. And actually, early in my upbringing, then I was sent to live with my mother's mother and father in a farm in Waterford while my parents were split up. But then probably actually the key thing that happened was when I was five, my parents decided to go to Germany. But ridiculously, they asked me, five years of age, would you like to stay or would you like to come to Germany with us? I thought that was rather ridiculous and rather strange that a five-year-old should be given the choice of. And I was getting on great in school and everything, and I was having a great time. So I went, I'm happy here. And off they went to Germany with my brother. So they went off to live in Germany, and I was left in Waterford with my grandparents, with whom I was having a lovely time, and I was doted upon and loved and all that. But of course, as anybody with a brain could work out, that kind of separation probably had long term impact on your psyche and on your sort of feeling. What I'm trying to say, Carl, is I was abandoned.
Yeah, well, look, I know you're going to try and turn this funny. I'm going to keep you serious, though. It's like Churchill had a quote, and I'm just paraphrasing, but it was along the lines of like every great man has a troubled childhood. I think it went for him, the likes of George Washington. There's all these people who do great things, and they are a troubled childhood. Is it fair to say your childhood was troubled? I mean, it blows you up when your parents are gone suddenly. And in fact, it quite often is used almost as a method, for instance, in royal families around the world, where they send the children away at quite a young age to break that familial bond, and it helps harden them up for some of the decisions they'll make later in life. Did it have that effect on you? Did it hurt your ability to feel emotions and love?
I think it had two sides to it. So one was joyous and the other was terrible. The terrible part of it was I wasn't able to admit it, because basically I don't really understand. My parents had gone away to Germany.
To do what, by the way?
They went to live there. Ireland was not happening. It was just terrible. It was the 70s in Ireland. It was awful. And he had contacts in Germany. And I suppose his father was in Germany. His father had gone back to Germany. My grandfather. And so basically I was kind of left in Ireland. And really I was loving Ireland. So I was loving my school and I was loving my kind of little peer group and being on the farm and the kind of closeted, bond, warm relationship that I had with my grandmother and grandfather. But at the same time, there would have been deep-seated and early onset, what the fuck is going on here? Why, did I do something wrong to you know, what did I do? Because everybody else was in a different situation to me. They were there with their folks, and I was there with my grandparents. But my folks were still there, except they were in another country. So I do think it affected me emotionally. Being honest about it, a lot of people, including my wife, say to me, I can't believe you ended up so normal, bearing in mind kind of thing, what kind of happened. Because they came back from Germany then later, and then they kept splitting up again, and we were living together, and then they split up again, and then they'd fight and argue and all that sort of stuff.
Sometimes you actually come better for it. I don't know if I told you this before, my grandmother, she was married like 14 times, like unbelievable mad shit. And my dad was just one of the nicest people you'll ever meet.
Mm.
And I think he just rejected that whole chaos. And I'm not saying that that's what you do, but I just, you know, you actually can kind of come back from that, you know, it looks like you have.
I think one of the important things that I remember from my childhood is that although I wasn't receiving, as I thought of it, the essential love of a parent, I was having a lot of love given to me. So in other words, my grandparents and my auntie and stuff, they were like pouring love into me. And I think that's what really matters, that you get love no matter where it's coming from. It doesn't necessarily have to be from your mother or your father. It's important that you are loved, loved unconditionally. That kind of, you know when an unconditional love is given to you. And that gives you this strength and power, maybe a bit of confidence. And that's what I was getting from them.
You feel more towards them, like that parental love, than you do, say, towards your own parents?
I do.
And are your parents still alive?
Yes, they are. Both of them are still alive, and we both sort of, and we struggle through this. And, and I'm not saying it's a great situation, but that's really, I felt much more as if my grandparents had kind of brought me up than my parents. And then later, when my parents came back and I was kind of about 13 or 14, that was another, again, they kind of split up again. And I was kind of left, my brother and myself were kind of left with nowhere to live. And so we were living with aunts, uncles, friends. For a time, I was couch surfing.
What age were you then?
14, just 13 or 14. And for a time, I was couch surfing.
And Rene was in the same situation?
Yeah, he had then been put down to boarding school in Cork. And soon after, it was judged that basically I'd have to go to boarding school in Cork as well. Listen, you don't choose the family you are given, you know. I mean, I'm very kind of drawn to that. I love that. I love that Bob Dylan song called Not Dark Yet. It's from...
it's not a great song. It's not dark yet, but it's getting there.
Yeah.
Shadows are falling and I've been here.
Do you know it?
Of course
I
do.
Yeah, Time Out of Mind is an album he wrote in 97. And there's a beautiful line towards the end of the song. And he sort of goes, it's the last verse, and he goes, I was born here and I'll die here. Against my will. Yeah. And again, because he's such a brilliant poet, he's able to say something in such simple terms, two little phrases that mean the world. And what he's saying is, it's not our choice that we're born, conceived, born, and it's not our choice that we die. We don't choose any of this. We're just thrust into this place and suddenly you're going, go on, deal with that. And so to the same extent, you are not choosing the family you are given. Now, you choose the family that you make, obviously, but you're not choosing the family that you're given. And the dynamic that exists between you and your family is often, as Irish people know damn well, is often a very difficult thing. And it's difficult to deal with. And sometimes rather than reopen old wounds or constantly, you know, look to make the same mistakes all over and over again, it's better just to step back and remove it. I used to have friends in school when I was young. I used to see them going home. I used to think that they were closing the door and going into this lovely fireplace and that their mum was there and their dad was there and it was all this Waltons. Little House on the Prairie meets the Waltons. Now, it wasn't, but that's what I thought that would do. And so I was going, maybe someday, you know, I could have a family like that, you know, or maybe something deep inside me wanted something like that. And so pretty much one of my biggest ambitions, whether I wanted to admit it or not, was to try and have a stable family background. And that is what I have. And that's what makes me so happy now, that I actually do have a loving and stable family. And it's one of the few things I can say for sure. Like, you can't say anything for sure, really, in life.
No, almost.
But when you know your very, very close loved ones love you and that you love them, that's what you can say. That's one of the most beautiful feelings you can have in your life. In a world where the older you get, you can't be sure of anything, Carl. You know, in fact, when you're young, you're sure of everything. When you get a few years on, you say, well, I'm not so sure about certain things. When you're older, you go, I'm not sure of anything. But if there's one thing you can be sure about, is the love of her and him and her, well, those little people in your family, then that's something that pretty much I've always wanted. Beyond anything else, I think.
So you're succeeding on that front. I mean,
No, I'm completely succeeding.
When did you meet your wife?
I met her when I was 25. We met in a place called the Clarence Hotel at a nightclub called the Kitchen Nightclub, which was Bono's nightclub.
Yeah, I used to work in Lily's Bordello, and sometimes if I got off early, we'd go down there because doormen all knew each other and they'd kind of let us.
Yeah, yeah. So it would have been one of the mad nights there, you know, and I was a couple of years out of college, and I'd had a lot of frisking around for a few years.
You're about to say a lot of drugs that night.
Well, frisking around for a few years, and maybe it was a time to, I kind of had.
Did you just bump into her?
Yeah, totally bumped into her on the dance floor.
So you see this woman on the dance floor, you're like, whatever, she looks nice. Sorry, I dropped my pen.
She looks, it was worse. It was like, it's the most ridiculous thing that happened ever, right? So we're in the Kitchen Nightclub. I see this beautiful girl. She's wearing a kind of an Angora top and a suede, brown short suede miniskirt. And we just caught each other's eye. I know this is, I'm going to get sick saying this even. We walked towards each other and the first thing we did was kissed.
Okay, that's it.
I'm going to set it. Everybody listening to the podcast, stop getting sick. All right? But it did happen.
That's actually how it happened. I heard stories like that. I only heard a story last week about like a guy who asked his boss, he met a girl at a bar, he's working at a bar, and he's like, I like this girl, I think I'm in love, can I get off early and go out for dinner? And they're married, you know. And actually, my mother, when she was introduced to my dad, he was over here from the USA, and a friend introduced him to my mom and said, this is Ginny, you know, she's looking for a husband, I figured you'd do, I'll be the best man, godfather to the first child. My mother was horrified, nearly slammed the door, and so that's how it worked out. You know, so this, I love these stories.
Well, it's worse because it's actually cringy, because then after we kissed, I said, you don't know how to kiss properly. Now, that's really awful.
There's something about you that kind of, I can't say I'm entirely surprised by that one.
That was just completely over the top, uncalled for, arrogant, and
do you still get reminded of that to this day?
Yeah, the odd time.
Okay, well then, that shows it was a true original sin, and you've paid for it many times. So, what's your wife's name?
Blonnet.
Blonnet. So, where's Blonnet from?
So, Blonnet is from the north side of Dublin, Raheny. And I was, if you like, a pretty much an arrogant, cocky, a kind of a Southsider, I suppose you would say. Very confused, very flighty. And it turned out Blonnet was probably that kind of yin to my yang, that kind of steadiness, common sense, sweet, kind, gentle, not non-harsh, non-judgmental, and that kind of.
How long until you knew you were in love with her?
I'd say a couple of months, and then after about a year with her, then I got the heebie-jeebies. So I started doing that asshole thing where the guy goes, no, I think I need to have a talk with her and tell her this is all over because I can't be getting involved in a relationship. So I tried to have the chat with her, and then she just said, shut up, just shut up, this isn't going to happen, we're together. And it was the way she actually poo-pooed completely what I said, and dismissed out of hand my preordained attempts that I was going to. In her mind, she knew we were good together. And my stupidity, confusion, second thoughteries were just idiotic.
I think guys just spend an inordinate amount of time complaining about women, but you know what? You find a good one, damn, they're worth it. They really are.
The other thing was,
make it all right.
She, I don't know, I think every relationship is based on this. She basically said, She basically said, you have a really good heart. And she completely believes that. And that sold me completely. The idea that I think she was just able to look into me. That's it. And that's what I think a partnership is. That's what I think two people falling in love together are.
I'm going to just, because you said you're 25, at that stage you'd already started Gift Grub, you know, you had moderate success. Talk to me about, like, when you were in school, were you a trash student, great student, you used to get in trouble much, what were you like? Because I want to bring us forward into that part of your life chronologically.
I was a people pleaser, so I wanted to please the teacher. But at times I was a little bit unruly as well, and I wanted to show the teacher that I could be a little bit of a problem if I wanted to be. So I could be their best friend, or I could be a problem for them.
You want these little, like, funny pain in the arse types?
A little bit, yeah. I sometimes organise little mini class revolutions, thinking that if the teacher, I could gang up on the teacher if I wanted. I wanted to maybe show the teacher that I had power, although I wanted to be the teacher's best friend as well. But if the teacher wasn't giving me what I wanted, I might show the teacher, listen, I could organise a little posse here against you and start a little coup d'etat.
The Rosenstock Bolsheviks.
Yeah, sort of a little Bolshevik in me, maybe a kind of a social justice thing again, kind of a Bolshy sort of not wanting to, a bit incendiary, a bit trying to be different.
And then, so you did your leaving cert, did you go to college?
Yeah, so I went to Trinity and I did politics and economics. But the only reason I went to Trinity was to join the Drama Society, the Players, which I had been obsessed with going to Trinity for about 3 years because I discovered acting in school. And I went, the way to do acting is to go to this amateur dramatic society in Trinity.
Why didn't you just go to acting school?
Because it wasn't as good as the amateur dramatic society in Trinity. Basically, this Players, what it's called, used to churn out loads and loads of actors and directors that went on to make it in Ireland and, you know, even the world, like Dominic West, the guy from the Wire and everything, was in my sort of class in the Players and everything. We did plays together, and Kathy Belton, who's a big star now in The Abbey and stuff like that, and lots of other people in directing and acting around England and America and Ireland, went to Trinity, and you just did loads of plays there and got semi-professional experience, and then you got reviewed in the Irish Times. And so you were reviewed as a professional. So you're like 20 years of age, 19 years of age, and you're reviewed as a professional. So it was like, get your hands dirty, roll your sleeves up and do it.
So you got politics and economics. Did you get a decent score on that? Like, we used
just an honours degree. Yeah, just scrape through.
That's just wonderful, because you didn't scrape through getting an honours degree. You got to be decent enough to
just all right. Like, yeah.
But I mean, it was no, like, give away easy scores back in the, you know.
But I loved it. I loved the whole politics and stuff like that, you know. So, and that really informed later doing sketches and everything, because I could feel confident talking about politics and economics and things.
So I'm guessing, just from talking, you know that you're naturally funny, or you've got a good turn of wit, turn of phrase. You're studying economics and politics. A lot of people, that's just boring stuff. But you're doing that. You're in this drama society. Like, how do you morph from that into being funny and getting your break on radio? What was the?
Well, I was an actor, so I was doing acting. I was on stage. I was in Glenroe and stuff like that. But I'd always been doing voices.
How'd you get the Glenroe role?
Oh God, that was just, I was in school and college, and literally I was doing a school play, a play in Trinity, and this agent came to see the play and said, "Would you like to be a professional actor? You think you've got what it takes to be a professional actor?" And I was basically, saw this letter on the board, and I was going around brandishing this letter to all my friends and students, going, "I have the letter." I was like Neville Chamberlain, you know, with the white piece of paper going around, "I have the letter." Remember, this is pre-email, pre-internet, and so letters were all we had. And so then I got this part in Glenroe, which was the doctor, a part of a doctor. This paper started calling me the dishy doctor after a while, and I was only 21. So, but I'd always been doing voices in class, at home, skits with my grandmother.
One of the ways you'd pull the piss out of your mates is do an impression of them.
Exactly. And obviate bullying as well. If anybody was trying to bully you,
Did you get bullied?
Not really, but once or twice, you know, like any kid, when the big boy in class turned his attention to you, you know, then, what would you do? So my thing was to do an impression of him, and then all the eyes would turn to him. And of course, that's just the worst thing you can do to somebody, to shine a light of, because our biggest fear in life is to be humiliated. And when you do an impression of somebody or hold a kind of a mirror up to them, you kind of, in a way, humiliate them slightly. Yeah. So I learned the kind of power of impressions, the power of doing a pastiche of somebody or a voice or a kind of the face that they make very early. And so
I'd like you to try me someday on the faces. Your phone.
And how do you know I haven't, Carl? I've done quite a few times. Patrick would be well aware of my impression of you. But if you throw Tourette's into the mix there.
As I say, it's like fucking people try and take a photo of me. I'm like, this is like wildlife photography. You get a good one of me, you can go join the National Geographic.
Well, no, for my listeners who don't know, Carl is very open about talking about his Tourette's. And of course, I don't want to do an impression of Carl now with his Tourette's.
You can throw one in at the end. I actually have an impression for you to do at the end, so you can tag my one on at the end of it.
So then basically I was kind of an actor, but an actor's life is very, wasn't for me, because an actor's life, you need to be a certain type of personality. And really the personality you need to be is a personality who's used to doing nothing. Because 90% of an actor's life is spent not working. And I just, the energy I had, I couldn't tolerate not working. I would immediately go out drinking. I'd destroy myself. I had too much energy to just do that thing where you can bide your time, do a yoga class, work as a teacher, enjoy your free time. I wasn't able to do that. I needed to be busy. And so it just so happened that at the time, this new radio station, Radio Ireland, was starting. And they were looking for new talent, and I sent them in some stuff, blah, blah, blah. Didn't get anywhere. But eventually everybody got fired from Radio Ireland, because there's about 150 people working for them, and about 100 people got fired. And they kept on over, you know, turning over people all the time. And I went in, and I two flatmates I was sharing a flat with in most.
Radio Ireland what became today FM?
Radio Ireland's what became today FM.
So that's like, I heard you interview Dave Moore before about this, where he was talking about how he got started. He just kind of got a call and he was just thrown straight in. Is that how you got started?
It was a fluke again. So basically I was living in a flat in Monkstown, and there was two New Zealand girls who were traveling the world who were living in the flat with me. And one of the girls was a radio producer back in New Zealand, and she started working as a part-time radio producer for the little while she was here in Today FM, Radio Ireland. And she was a radio person, and she used to come back in the evening and I'd be at home in the flat. And every morning she'd hear me.
So you're this like semi-employed actor.
Unemployed actor.
Okay, unemployed actor.
Unemployed 26-year-old actor in the house and in the flat. And she hears me in the showers in the morning, and I'm doing impressions of Gerry Adams having a shower with Martin McGuinness or whatever. And the girl, her and her friend would be outside the door laughing at this, what they thought was maybe just unstable individual doing voices in the shower. And then once she went to me, they had an idea at work. They went, Mario, that Gerry Adams, could you ring us in one morning and just do Gerry Adams complaining about a Britney Spears song? So it was Oops Baby One More Time or something. And I started ringing and complaining about Oops Baby One, Hit Me Baby One More Time. And I thought nothing of it. And she came home that evening and she went, oh, there was loads of calls about your thing. And actually one of the guys wants to call you. And so called me and said, do you do more voices? And I went, I was in that stage in my career where I was going, nothing's happening.
Anything.
Yeah, exactly. I'd give it a shot. So I got into a taxi, went in front of a mic, and I did about 80 voices for these guys, including things like Bertie Ahern and stuff, who was the new Taoiseach. Mm-hmm. And they were impressed. I thought it was just a tool of an actor, that like you should be able to do these voices almost. But they went, no, these are great. And they went, can you write? And I went, no. And they went, do you think you could write? And I went, doubt it. Never written comedy in my life. And I went, well, try. So I basically started. I couldn't really write. I didn't know how to write a gag. I didn't know how to write a sketch. But they said, think of an idea. And so I thought of an idea. And at the time, the peace process was really the main thing that everybody was talking about in Ireland. You'd see it night after night and day after day. All we talked about was David Trimble and Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness. The other thing that was really massive in society from a cultural point of view was Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Jeez, yeah.
Right? It was massive. The original Star Trek, of which I'd been a huge fan in the 60s, Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly and all that. I loved that show. But this was a remake of our continuation of Star Trek.
Data and all these new characters.
Yeah. And so it was big culturally. So I actually thought of an idea, which was, it proved to be the sort of way GIF Grub has always gone, which is to try and fold two things that are totally different in together at the same time. So basically, I tried to fold the peace process in with Star Trek. So I created a small... Carl is looking at me. He's gone full Tourette's.
happens every now and then.
He's gone full noddies on this one. So I created this thing called a Star Trek Starship Compromise. So it was a starship in which Gerry Adams was the captain and Martin McGuinness was his number one. And they would fly around the galaxy looking for compromise with alien civilizations. Not for war, but for compromise, because that's all this the peace process was about. Gerry Adams was talking about compromise, though. Compromise, compromise. You know, fighting war, yeah, but compromise. And David Trimble, compromise, compromise. And so I was going out to these alien civilizations and they'd go to the planet of the Daniel O'Donnells or the planet of the Michael Flatleys, and they tried to compromise with them and all this sort of stuff. So the episodes would last 1.5 minutes, and I was doing them at night in the TFM and going home, hearing no reaction. I remember once then I went to a bar in Black Rock, and two lads were at the bar and went, "Cheers, Starship compromised this morning." And that was a real bolt for me, just to hear two strangers going, saying the thing I had done. "Did you hear Starship compromised?" And I went, "That's my thing." Right, there, and soon after then, I heard Ian Dempsey was going, newly employed, "Look who we poached for breakfast, Ian Dempsey, biggest star in radio in Ireland, in breakfast radio, was coming to Today FM." And
he came from what, Zig and Zag or something?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he was saying to the guys, I'd worked with comedy and Zig and Zag and all this.
If you're not 50, they were two puppets, basically, and there was a show, and he used to talk to these two alien puppets called Zig and Zag.
And Zig and Zag then went on to become huge in England, and they did the big breakfast with Chris Evans and all that sort of stuff. And they were two imaginary, so two little puppets, two funny little puppets. And so Ian would hear this Starship compromise carry on, which I was doing on my own in a room in Today FM at night after things like Glen Row, and no idea what I was talking about, actually. I just put the music under it and then just go, Northern Ireland, the final frontier, you know, these are the stories. And then it's just, we do the sketch. And so Ian said, "What about that guy who's doing the thing in the morning before we come on?" And 5 to 7 in the morning. And I went, "Mario." And said, "Do you want to meet Mario?" And Ian said, "Why not? Nothing to lose." And that was the moment then. The moment really was me and Ian meeting. And me and Ian meeting then was, I didn't realise at the time, but completely pivotal moment where I was meeting this basically legend of radio. And he was kind of at the beginning of his journey and maybe looking for people to work with. But what really worked was, I guess, our sense of humours complemented each other. They weren't the same, but they were close to each other.
Like your sense of humour, obviously, you pull the piss out of everyone in their own little way. Have you ever actually bothered someone? Has it ever gotten back to you that, yeah, so-and-so, like, they were properly upset by that?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyone in particular that you can mention?
Yeah, I mean, from my understanding of it, Michael Flatley really does not like this kind of piss take of him. And I'm not surprised, because I think he feels that it's, I sort of think he thinks, like, you know, why would he be taking the piss out of me? I'm an ambassador for Ireland. I'm travelling the world and I'm hoofing and I'm playing me flute and I'm doing Ireland proud, and this guy is making an absolute fool of me. Cry, you know, who does he think he is?
Have you ever had an urge to apologise to anyone that you offended?
No. No, why? Because I don't think, I think as long as I stay within the realms of what they do publicly, I think I'm fine.
Anyone ever like send you legal letters or shit like that?
Nope. Nope. I really would be averse to making fun of somebody's private life if it wasn't out there, or saying something below the belt. I believe that Dave Grubb is quite gentle, and that the humour is quite gentle, and anything that is done, which it's implied. I think the listener can make up their mind where you're going and what you're getting at a lot of the time.
One thing I would say, I've heard people talk about woke comedy, and to me that's just not funny at all. Like, there's no joy in it. But what you do is still pretty safe, but it's usually pretty damn funny as well. How do you keep doing that? I mean, like, how do you stay creative? What's your average day like?
I had a rewiring of my brain around 2000, year 2000. I was doing Gift Grub for a very short period of time, and I was putting all my energy into doing Gift Grub sketches. And I remember I did one sketch which worked really, really well. I'd put all my energy into it, and Ian and the guys said there was a brilliant reaction to it in the morning, and I kind of wanted to go out and party. And I went, "So what's tomorrow?" And I went, "Tomorrow? We have to go again tomorrow. What's tomorrow?" And that gave me the shock of my life. Basically, you have to keep producing this material for radio, and it's nonstop. It's going to eat up material the whole time. And I remember started crying, and I had to go home for a few days, and just kind of, I was shaking, and I had to go come to terms with this. What's going on here now?
I actually cried.
Yep.
Well, actually, quick second.
I'm going to do an impression of myself crying.
No. When's the last time you cried? And for what?
Jeepers. Do you know what? I was looking at Robert Redford and Paul Newman just about to jump off a cliff in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid yesterday on YouTube, and it brought a tear to my eye.
Why?
Because I was watching Magic. Generally, I cry or get a bit emotional, not from something sad, but from something magical. When I see magic being made, or when I see moments of magic happening, and you go, they're bottling it, they're capturing it, and then it's gone as soon as it's made. So I was kind of feeling nostalgic for that magic that they had created. I just absolutely love beauty and magic moments being created in song, in music, in film, theatre. It just makes me quite emotional because of all the stuff that's made, very rarely you get to that little point where that little piece of absolute magic is made, and it makes me very emotional to see it. So I was, he had just died, and I was watching his beauty and the beauty he had in chemistry with Newman, the little moment they created, and it just makes me emotional.
Okay. And if I want to get back to then, so you're punching out all this material.
Yeah, and so basically what I had to do was...
How old were you when you had your first child? Or when Blondet had your first child?
So Dash was, I was 37.
So you kind of waited a long time then.
Yeah, yeah. And we were a bit unfortunate, to be honest, with miscarriages and stuff.
Like a stack of them? Or?
Yeah, four.
Yeah, that's hard.
It was, yeah.
And she was still willing to keep...
Yeah. And stuff and... Oh yeah, but it was... I think it's one of the saddest things that can happen to anybody, the miscarriage. Again, it's one of those things. Ireland has started talking about this a lot more. I mean, the whole mental health debate, everything we talk about, we're better at talking about everything. And miscarriages is one of them. But it's one of those things that doesn't get talked about because it's so... Something happens, you're going to have a baby, and then suddenly somebody meets you months later and they're looking at you and there's no baby and you can't speak about it. So all this anticipation is gone. It's tremendous emotional and physical pain for Blondet, for the mum. And obviously a lot of pain for the putative dad. It's one of the saddest things. It's one of the saddest things people can go through, I think, because it's swept under the... It's deliberately and almost socially swept under the carpet. Mm-hmm. And as it almost has to be, out of politeness. People don't want to talk about your... unfortunate what happened to you, you know? So yeah, we kept trying and listen, we weren't unusual. Especially when I was doing the radio show, The Sunday Roast, I had talked to lots of people who, and since, of course, who've had lots and lots of miscarriages. And of course, it's a feature of all our lives, of women's lives, you know, to have loads of miscarriages. And we were just the same as anybody else. We just kept trying. And eventually it happened, you know? But I mean, even then, I regard us as lucky because he's here. Like, I know loads of people even in this building and they've gone through IVF for years and it took either never worked or it's gone, you know, took ages to work.
And like, how do you deal with pain, actually, I suppose? Like, obviously, like, women deal with pain, in particular around things like miscarriages, in probably a vastly different way than men do. My own view is probably a mixture for me, at least, of kind of denial, not talking about it, rage, you know, the usual kind of mix. But what's your antidote? Like, how do you work through it
for dealing with emotional pain? I think a bit like yourself. I think a little bit of denial, not so much rage, a kind of a pretending it's not there. So I think I use the imaginary side of my brain almost to deny that it's there.
Can you still be funny when things are going wrong in your life?
I was thinking about this yesterday, and that, do you know what? That very thought entered my head yesterday. I've been so lucky with... Somebody rang me yesterday and went, I can't do this podcast. And I went, why? And they went, I know this sounds weird, but my dog died. And I kind of went, oh, yeah, well, you know, people are really close to their pets. And the person went, like, I'm devastated. And I'm not in the mood to be doing comic or funny things tomorrow. And I went, I totally understand, yeah. Like, dogs, cats, everything, we're so close to them. But it didn't happen. Things like that haven't happened to me much. And the only thing I can say is that I believe I would just feckin' try and block it out, which is a terrible thing to say in a way. But I have to keep going. I have to keep getting the job done. And I don't know, because nothing really, really bad has happened that I can remember in the last number of years that has stopped me from doing the job, but I can't imagine. Do you know what I mean? I don't know what I would do, but I would have to, I think, find some way of keeping going.
And then, so then tell me then, say, about your kids. So, you know, you had these tragedies. You eventually were blessed with a child. You were 37, you're 55 now. So you have a child who's 18. You've got another child.
12.
12 and 18. Some interesting ages, boys or girls?
So Dash is 18 and he's doing his leaving cert. And Bellamy, she's 12.
And what are they like?
So she's like me. So she's kind of got this sparkiness and
mischief
and the independence and kind of get out of my way. This is going to happen. Nothing's going to stop me. And he's kind of got more blonde, a little bit of quietness, introspection and thoughtfulness. And I'm glad that he does.
what do they want to do with themselves, or do they know?
I don't really know. He loves music and he loves rap and he loves DJs and he loves being independent. So he's definitely got a strong feeling of independence as well. And she is strong, loves tennis and loves her daddy.
Yeah, daughter love is something different, I'll tell you.
Isn't it? I've never experienced anything like it. It's beautiful.
It is. It is. You know, I grew up with four sisters, and I have to say, I just never understood women despite it. But I definitely understand young women's or young girls' ability to manipulate fathers now in a way that I just never.
It's unstoppable.
Yeah, they're a force. You know,
you're lost. You're just gone. You can't stop it.
And you, like, as a parent, what are you like? You're like, oh, do whatever you want. I'm happy. I love you as long as you're happy. Or
no, again, it's a balance. Again, it's a balance between, we talk it out. Again, it's a balance between being blonde. I mean, kids try to do this thing where they try to divide and conquer.
Oh, they're brilliant.
Let's find the weakest link, chop them up, go to work on their ass and break it up. I mean, with him, I'm kind of a lot in common in terms of films. I have a little thing in my phone called Films with Dash. So from the time he was 7 or 8, I've been trying to watch the world's greatest films with him. You know, I remember when he was 14, I said, is he ready for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? And he was...
not even ready for that, I'm fit.
And I went, he is ready for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But hilariously, here's what happened when he was about 14. I started showing him One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And he went, after 3 minutes, he went, yeah, I think I know what's happening here. And I went, what do you mean you think you know what's happening here? The guy with the hat, McMurphy. And I went, McMurphy, yeah, and Jack Nicholson. He's going to go into the insane asylum and kind of show them all that they're not really as insane as they thought they were. And that really they're being mistreated and that they're just, you know. And I went, how did you know all this? And the reason he kind of knew it was kids nowadays are exposed to narrative in a way that you and I were never exposed when we were young.
There's always films that'll like catch you off guard, like Deliverance or...
Yeah, but gaming...
Dead by Dawn.
But gaming and Fortnite... And YouTube teaches kids narrative all the time in short form. They learn narrative so quickly. So they're really cute to seeing narrative and things. They're looking out for it. Whereas when I watch a film, I'm always kind of going, let's just this film bathe over me here and see what it's like. He was cute to it straight away going, I think I know what's going to happen. Anyway, I have a little file on my phone going Films with Dash and we watch films together. And
do you worry about them?
Do I worry about them? No, I don't. I don't want to spend time and energy worrying about them. I just want to do my very best to be there for them.
With so much going on, are you good at being present?
Yep, I am, I think. And that's one of the things, that exact thing, being present, is the one thing all I wanted to do. Not to be the best dad in the world, not to be like, read a book and go, I know how to be a dad. Just to actually go, I don't think there's pretty much anything better you can do than just being there. Being there with them in the moment, just doing things and just being there for their things. Do you know when you, see those, do you know when you see those?
I want to stop you super quick and just tell me about your own dad. What was a happy memory you have with him?
Happy memory of him with him was him playing tennis with me and me smashing a backhand down the line when he served his best serve. And
have you done that with your kids? Have you given them one of those moments?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Or him teaching me chess and then beating him on the 36th occasion that I played him in chess.
There's a theme here of just battering your dad at the...
Well, no, that's...
There's a wider spectrum.
Well, no, I think that's what kind of... you know, dads and kids do together. They kind of, the dad teaches, should teach the kid things until the kid is good enough to be as good as them or better.
If you were ever playing, say, you know, your daughter in tennis, would you ever let her win?
No, she wouldn't want me to let her win. And we're doing that currently. So we're doing that currently.
Unless they win fair.
We're doing that currently. She doesn't want that. We're doing that currently. And like, she's getting better and better and better. She's getting good. And I'd say it'll be a year and a half before she's able to beat me. And
like, would you say to yourself, objectively, like, if you were to die tomorrow, you think they'd be just fine then? I'm not saying they wouldn't miss you or be sad, but I'm saying, have you raised them to a point where you think, you know, I hope so.
But I wouldn't be, it wouldn't be just me. Blondie would still be there. But, you know, yeah, I think they're emotionally sound.
That's great. Well done. I just want to have a few more little things, and then we'll start wrapping up. I hope, listeners, that you've really gotten an insight into a man that you haven't gotten in this way, at least in the past.
Connor is enraptured anyway over there. He's absolutely enthralled.
Tell me, say, who's your top like two Irish comedians? Because I'm always curious about like how you riff off others. Like when I play guitar, and there's like guitarists I'd love to be. Do you have any guys like that in the world or in Ireland?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I do. First of all, I love all comedy. I mean, and I'm loath to say Tommy Tiernan because everybody says Tommy Tiernan. But I will say Tommy Tiernan on the basis that he mixes a certain kind of philosophy and a spirituality and a why are we here-ness and what the fuck is it all about? A kind of a Waiting for Godot, a kind of a Samuel Beckett thing going on in a true Irish style, Flann O'Briney kind of feel, with some down-to-earth outrageous commentary, with funny voices, with simple humour. He also has a really uncanny ability to bring subjects back to the kernel of what it's all about. I remember he started talking about, do you ever think about the world financial fucking crisis? I owe you money. He owes him money. India owes China money. China owes Tunisia money. Tunisia owes Gaddafi money. Gaddafi owes Borneo money. But there's a big line of people who owes each other. I'd like to go to the fella at the end of the line and go, just fucking kill him. Then nobody would owe anybody fucking money. I remember thinking, that's what a beautiful way of summarising the world debt problem. Because if you look, you know finance. If you think about, you hear these statistics. The world owes 30 trillion. To who?
The world.
The world, you know? Yeah. Or the world's money is 30 trillion, but we owe 60 trillion. How can that be? How can we owe more than we have as a planet? I've always said this, and I've always thought he's great. It's David McSavage as well.
David McSavage is a beast. Oh my God.
He's a savage beast. And I really do love Dave McSavage. And I love him because of his...
He's absolutely nuts. Like to be around just that energy. But he says stuff. I can't find it. There's a clip where he was talking about life insurance. He's like, you want to get life insurance because you'd be brown bread. Call 11-11-12. And even my son, who's never seen the skit, sometimes say, how much is that t-shirt? It's 12. Like he's riffing up. Yeah. He said, and it was just...
Yeah.
Just brilliant.
Yeah, my son Dash loves him as well now, you know, and Dash is at that age, again, 18 and stuff. He likes David and David McSavage's old clips from The Savage Eye and stuff. So I think David has this kind of vulnerability that allows him to be silly. And I think when we all tap into that thing where you can allow yourself to be silly, I think you get places. But you have to allow yourself to be silly. And, you know, David does that. Now, having said that, I really think it's unfair just to single out a couple of people because I also love technical comedians who are just technically brilliant at what they do.
Yeah.
People like Neil Delamere, they write great jokes. I watched Neil Delamere in a thing just dealing with crowd work with the audience and I thought, Jesus, that was quick. He was fantastic. Jason Byrne, a completely different type of comic. In the last few years, I've got into watching more of Deirdre O'Kane because she's kind of got into this almost middle-aged woman humor, where she, you know, she's a beautiful woman, but she's got into that thing of she's found a kind of a métier. She's found a kind of a real little seam of gold that she's been mining for a few years now, and she's brilliant. And so are
internationally. Who'd be your favorite? Like, do you have an all-time my favorite man? That's my go-to.
Well, I mean, I'm going to do a Trump answer to this and just all of them. But unlike Trump, I will name them, right? So, I mean...
Top, say, three. The three that you say, like...
Stand-up comedians.
No, it could be...
When somebody walks into a room, okay, I have different criteria. I've never seen anybody being able to walk into a room of stiff people and within 30 seconds they are folded on the floor. Jim Carrey can do that.
Yeah.
Jim Carrey can walk into a room of people with dicky bows. They go, like,
just
let's say, like,
expressions alone.
Let's just say, like, one of those stiff Hollywood things where it's like, the IFI appreciates Martin Scorsese, and you hear this voiceover going, "Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Jim Carrey." Polite applause. All Hollywood stiffs there. He walks in. 40 seconds later, there are people nearly throwing up into a bucket. The genius of the guy with his sense of madness, his sense of just crazy. But just his sense, right? Robin Williams, Will Ferrell. Will Ferrell is somebody I can just look at his face and just fall asunder laughing. I mean, he's clearly a genius, Will Ferrell. There's no question about it.
A lot of American comedians there.
Then politically, George Carlin. I love that sort of stuff. But Richard Pryor, Chris Rock, and Eddie Murphy's early stuff, unbelievable. Let me see then. And then British comedy. I mean, I can't stand people who don't like Michael McIntyre. Michael McIntyre is an amazing comedian. Just because you're jealous of him and he's made, you know, 100 million quid doesn't mean he's still not good. You can make loads of money and be a brilliant comedian. Absolutely fantastic. Frankie Boyle sometimes makes me cry laughing, yeah, you know.
Old boy, that one, but yeah.
Ricky Gervais
him blows me away.
Yeah, but I'm very easy to please. If somebody is good at what they're doing, I'm going to be buying it. I'm going to be loving it, and I'm not a snob about it. I appreciate other people's good work, and you know, and obviously going back to my youth and everything. I mean, obviously I'm a bit of a Monty Python kind of fella as well, and Fawlty Towers and all that sort of stuff. But I used to love American sitcom as well, like Larry Sanders, and from the slightly bizarre world of Larry Sanders to Cheers and everything, straight sitcom, amazing stuff. So omnivorous. Yeah.
And tell me then, if you've had an amazing career, you know, the things that you say matter to you, you've been succeeding at. I'm sure you have your dark moments the way everyone does, but by and large, from inside talking out as you have now, it seems like you've done great, and outside in looks great too. But is there anything left on your bucket list? Anything that you're saying, I still have these couple of things I want to do?
Two things. Longevity. I'm a big fan of longevity. I'm a big fan of working and trying to grow within your work if you can, to an old age. In other words, to still be able to, like, I watched George Carlin on stage towards the end of his life, and you know, he was still fiery and angry and brilliant and older. Mm. I love that. My ambition is to be older and still loving what I do. And I'd love to do, I'm going to bring Gift Grub Live to, myself and Ian are going to go to London in February and do Gift Grub Live over there and try and adapt it a little bit for a foreign audience and see how that goes.
Brilliant. And Tammy, two more things. And this is the last question. The ultimate last bit is going to be an off the cuff request for an impersonation.
Oh, no.
Get ready for it. So I want you to imagine just for a moment that you're dead and you're wherever you go and you're looking back. What do you want to be remembered for? What do you think is the thing that if you say, you know, if people think about me, I hope they remember me this way?
Good dad. Sorry. I think good dad. That's what I want.
Because
beyond that, there's nothing really that works for me, you know.
It's kind of a nice way to tie everything about your story together, that end note. And now, just to put you on the spot,
not you,
I want you, yeah, can you imagine, yeah, doing an impression of the guy sitting right in front of you? No, it's I will have to see that someday. No, I want the best kind of semi-exaggerated impression of Mario Rosenstock from Mario Rosenstock.
Okay, well, Paul McClune, who helped create Gift Grub with me and Ian Dempsey in the early days, used to do an impression of me, which I really hated. And he used to do it after about 7 pints, and he used to go, yeah, me, you for a little bit, yeah, no, back to me, yeah, Ian, was that funny? Ian, was that funny? Am I funny? Is that working? Me. No, you. Okay, shut up. Not you anymore. Me. And we leave it with me.
Probably true.
I was hoping that would be a bit more of a dicky thing to catch you out on, but that's actually a great end. And you know, Mario, And I hope everyone listening did unmasking him a bit. I hope we did some of that and covered some fresh territory. You continue to be a guy who I love to talk to hear from, to learn about. And yeah, look, it's been great.
Oh, thank you so much, Carl. And Patrick, remember I told you, if it's not interesting enough, don't put it out.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week from the Mario Rosenstock podcast. My thanks to you, as always, for listening. If you can, tell one other person about this podcast if you enjoyed it and encourage them to listen to it. We have so many guests down through the last 4 years for you to scroll back and have a listen to. Really, really interesting interviews. I hope you'll agree. My thanks to deluxebathrooms.ie. Get down there as soon as you can or get online. We'll see you same time, same place next week.